Morning.
Good morning.
And good morning, you guys, way back there. You hear me? All right. Okay, so I'd like to begin with a poem by Pablo Neruda. And it was at that age, poetry arrived in search of me. I don't know. I don't know where from winter or a river. I don't know how or when. No, they were not voices. They were not words, nor silence. But from a street I was summoned, from the branches of abruptly from the others, among violent fires, or returning alone. There I was, without a face, and it touched me. So I read this poem when I was a young man, and I thought, wow, wow. And I thought, wow, because I felt like I had been summoned myself. I was kind of grandiose as a young man. I thought I had been summoned, not to poetry, although poetry is beautiful, but by my teacher, by my Zen teacher, to leave the street behind and enter a wonderful world of silence. Summoned to leave chaotic life. And enter a calm stillness. I felt like this little old guy summoned me to do that. And he still summoned me to do that, although he's been dead so long, a long time. So there are a lot of people here this morning. Some of you are curious. Some of you are trying to meditate, and some of you really have felt summoned to explore the depths of your being, to see if it's possible to discover something deeper than that hurly-burly, scattered, chaotic chatterbox cafe, right? Garrison Keillor's Chatterbox Cafe. We all know pretty well, don't we? Anybody who doesn't know the Chatterbox Cafe pretty intimately, raise your hand, and I will become your student. So not too long after I read this poem, my teacher, I lived in San Francisco at the time, and my teacher lived in San Francisco too. My teacher, two of my friends in their, if I remember correctly, red bug Volkswagen, took my teacher to Yosemite National Park. How many of you have been to Yosemite National Park? Raise your hands. Oh, less than half. Well, I grew up in California, so we always went to Yosemite National Park. And my teacher, whom we called Sensei, came back, and then the next morning, on Sunday morning, he gave a talk. And in his talk, he talked about going there and how beautiful, how wonderful it was, how beautiful it was, how peaceful it was. Then he talked about seeing the waterfall, Yosemite Falls. And he talked about how wonderful it was to see the waterfall. But then he noticed the tiny rivulets that seemed to have gotten separated from the falls, and how they were falling down separate, and how difficult it must be for them, is what he said. How difficult. So many of us, most of us, oh, come on in, let's see, there's this chair right there. And I don't know if there's a chair for... Oh, there's a cushion. Come on in. Um, so many of us feel like those little rivulets of times in our lives. Most of us do. Cut off from the stream. Cut off from the source. And just going down separately and alone. With isolation, with loneliness, with longing to merge with the stream, to merge with something bigger. We don't feel whole. We don't feel whole. Life is moving along like this falls without us, rushing by. And there we are. There we are, just a little rivulet all by itself. Pobrecita Tim. That's my name, you know. Pobrecito. Poor boy. Poor boy. A little bit of Spanish, I know. And it's possible for us to be summoned to discover within that stillness. I mean, with that cut-offness, a stillness, a sense of interconnectedness with something bigger. My teacher, Sensei, called this longing to return to the source. And he called this your inmost request. He said, have you discovered your inmost request yet? Not your regular request, but your inmost request. And he said, if you sit in meditation every morning and you sit for a whole week in retreat, that's the best way to get in touch with and honor your inmost request. Your inmost request. To feel our interconnectedness, to feel about that we're part of something larger, that we are something larger. And we try to do this in many ways that don't work very well, don't we? We try to do this in many ways that don't work very well. Or they work temporarily, give us temporary solace. So when my son was 1 year old, or roughly 1 year old, I don't know, he really seemed to be, he wanted to go back to the womb. He wanted to go back to the womb where it was nice and cozy and he was not cut off from anything. So he cried a lot. He cried all the time, unless his mother was nursing him or I was walking him. But there was one thing we were able to do. We tried the static on the radio, and if we could get the static just a certain way on the radio, he would stop crying. Finally, we got the vacuum cleaner. And through the vacuum cleaner, we could keep the vacuum cleaner on for 2 hours, and he'd be very peaceful. The minute we turned it off, he'd start crying. Well, we went to the doctor. He said, oh, those are in utero noises. He wants to return to the source. He wants to return to mama. And so, when I was an adolescent, when I was at my, cut-offness, I guess, pining away just to feel part of something, when I just felt the whole world was against me, and I fell in love, right? I fell in love with Mickey. That's not a very nice name, but at the time, whoa, Mickey. So, romantic love, adolescent love. Wow. We can lose ourselves. We can give ourselves up. We don't have the pain of isolation anymore. I would just drive by her house when I couldn't see her. That would help me. That would help me. Help me get through the day. Her picture in my wallet, that was good. Her picture on my bureau, that was better. Her picture in my bed, that was best. relief from our sense of, what is it? Just despondence, right? Just deep loneliness that we have as human beings. Deep loneliness. And of course, we long to experience something bigger. Something bigger. So, a couple weeks after my teacher went to Yosemite, I decided I better go to Yosemite to see what this is all about. Although I had been there many times as a kid, I had never noticed all the stuff he was talking about. So I went and I camped out. And I looked up at the Yosemite Falls, and I saw those rivulets off to the side. They didn't quite seem as despondent to me as it did to him, I guess. But, you know, it was his talk, you know, it was his Dharma talk. So, you know, anything is material for a Dharma talk, right? And then, but I did see that they were isolated, that they were off to the side, and that it was a huge, long way down to the bottom, and that it was a rushing fall. But then as I left the valley, I turned, or that part of the valley, I turned and looked at the falls, and the rivulets were the falls. From my big view, they were the falls. I didn't see any rivulets separate from the falls. I didn't see any falls separate from the rocks. I didn't see rocks separate from the trees. The rivulets are the falls. Are the falls. That's what we discover in our meditation practice. We discover that this tiny little rivulet with its angst is the fabric of the universe. And the Tibetan Buddhists call that panoramic awareness. A nice fancy name for what Suzuki Roshi called big mind, which is a okay name also, although I don't know why it has to be a mind. But anyway, you got to say something. So this big mind, this panoramic awareness, grows out of our meditation practice. And in our meditation practice, we have a chance to touch a deep longing, to touch our feeling of cut-offness, of not-okayness. And this means that we'll have lots of experience, lots more experience than we want of the Chatterbox Cafe. We don't want. We think maybe after 30 minutes of meditation, the Chatterbox Cafe will just go still. They won't have any customers. They'll put a closed sign down. And then we're really disappointed. They don't. The Chatterbox Cafe goes 24/7. Even in the middle of the treat, it's still gone. But within that Chatterbox Cafe, if we stay within it, if we stay just non-judgmentally within it, we'll see that it's interconnected with all life. We'll just see that. We'll just feel that in our hearts. And that's when our bare awareness, our focused meditation, turns into something really big, really big. So in your programs, I have two lines from the Harmony of Difference and Oneness by Sekito, which I've talked about before, the Chinese Zen teacher. So I talk a little bit about a couple of those lines. He says, in darkness there is light. In darkness there is light. Well, we're coming to the darkest time of year, aren't we? Coming to the darkest time of year. People's seasonal affective disorder is kicking in. My friends are all telling me. I never even heard of seasonal affective disorder before about 4 years ago. Now every other one of my friends has it. It's interesting. It's a dark time. It's a dark time. It's a time when we tend to feel cut off, when we tend to feel lonely. When we tend to feel kind of confused and even a little bit hopeless. Even if you don't have seasonal affective disorder, you're a human being. You're a human being. But it's also a time when we do our Rohatsu Sesshin. This is our 7-day retreat. And we've always done it. I mean, I can't say always, but for hundreds of years, we've done it at the darkest time of the year. We sit for a week. We sit and walk, we do meditate, and we eat, and we sleep for a week. For a week. So that we can really go into the darkness. We can really go in. We can really be there with it. Because in darkness there's light. In darkness there's light. Gradually, if we stay with this meditation process, we begin to see out the windows of the Chatterbox Cafe. Actually, the windows begin to turn into no windows at all, but just fresh air blowing through the cafe. The doors drop off. The cafe is still there, but it's teeming with wondrous life of the universe. And the chattering is very minimal because there's too much appreciation of the wondrous of life as it's unrolling, as it's unfolding, of the falls as it's precipitating down the rock. And when we do this, more and more we can begin to directly engage in our lives. Usually we don't directly engage in our lives because we engage in our lives through the mediation of the Chatterbox Cafe, right? The Chatterbox Cafe becomes the primary mediator of our lives. But we begin to see that we don't need that as a mediator. We don't need that mediation. And that doesn't mean, though, that there's some perfect bliss. We've got to go to some other religion if you want that. That after doing this practice, I've done this practice now for 49 years, give or take a few years, something like that. Doesn't mean that I get to have perfect bliss. Doesn't mean that I don't get upset. Doesn't mean that stuff. Basho, Zen teacher Basho, famous haiku poet Basho, after he'd been practicing meditation for many years and writing his haiku for many years, he was in Kyoto, Japan. Kyoto, Japan is the kind of the spiritual capital of Japan. That's where they had all the great. Now it's kind of touristy. You haven't been there. Anybody been there? Yeah. Oh, you guys have been there. Well, it's kind of touristy now, is that right, Leo? Yeah. But this was a spiritual center. This is where all the great Zen teachers lived and practiced, and they had all the great meditation halls. So here's Basho in the 18th century in Kyoto. Simple haiku. In Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo, longing for Kyoto. He's been practicing for 40 years. In Kyoto. Hearing the cuckoo, longing for Kyoto. So that deep longing to be connected with all life, longing to not be swayed by the cacophony of the Chatterbox Cafe is a lifetime process. A lifetime process. And the more we do this practice, the more our heart softens. The more it opens, the more responsive we become, and the more we experience our interconnectedness, even as a tiny rivulet, with everything, with the rocks, with the sky, with the water rushing down. And Basho was named Basho because, some of you may remember this. Do you remember this, Martin? Yeah, Martin remembers. Busho remembers my talks pretty well. But sometimes I don't remember. Let's see. Basho was named Basho because he lived in a little hut in the country. He did his Zen practice there. And of course, he traveled around Japan writing poems, which later he was considered the founder of haiku, but he didn't know what haiku was. You know, he just writing poems, right? His students gave him a little planted a little banana tree next to his hut, and Basho means banana tree. And so he took that name on for himself. And he was inspired by the way this tiny little tree stood out his outside his hut in the sun, in the wind, or in the rain. It was just there. So that became his teacher, that banana tree, his teacher, with its large leaves, with its soft leaves, with its fragility, open, just open. So Basho didn't get a Zen name from a Zen teacher because he didn't become ordained. He decided not to become ordained as a Zen monk, as a Zen priest. But he lived the life. He lived the Zazen life, the meditative life. And he definitely had been summoned. If you read his biography, you see how his autobiography, you see how he was summoned. How he was summoned to that great inner stillness. And how often it eluded him. Even in Kyoto, after practicing for, I don't know if it's 40 years, I just made that up. Long time. He was ordained, though. He was ordained by the authenticity of his heart's longing. That's the true ordination. That's the true ordination. Your heart's longing for something deeper, for something larger, for something broader. From a little quietness in the midst of the chatterbox cafe. That makes you an ordained person, whether you're a priest or a monk or a bozo, doesn't matter. You're ordained. And of course, in the Judaic Christian tradition, in our longing, we're in exile. We're alienated from God. We've been ripped out of the fabric of the universe. Right? I even learned that in the Unitarian Church, where I grew up. Even then. I don't think my minister really believed it, but... I don't know, I guess he did kind of... Yeah, I guess he did believe it. Yeah. But in our tradition... We can't be ripped out of the fabric of the universe because we are the fabric. How can we be ripped out of what we are? That rivulet is the whole waterfall. It's the whole waterfall. If you look at that rivulet, if you really look at it, you'll see the whole waterfall there. If you feel it, you'll feel the whole waterfall there. Right? Without judging, without criticizing, without chatterboxing, right? And then if the chatterboxing comes in, just let it come in. Just let it come in. Let it go out. In darkness there is light. In darkness there is light. So, around that time in my life, I also read Arthur Kessler, and Arthur Kessler. I think when I read him, that was the first time I read of anyone having this kind of panoramic awareness. I think so, because I read him. When I was very young. And then Arthur Kessler wrote The Lotus and the Robot later in his life. He was a pretty well-known author. But earlier in his life, he was a prisoner during the Spanish Civil War, fighting against the fascists. And he was in solitary confinement with no... just food and water, and he was going to be executed, waiting for his execution. A little bit of darkness there, huh? A little bit of darkness, yeah. Huge darkness. He was isolated. He was cut off. And here's what he says. To occupy my mind, I used a wire from my mattress to scratch mathematical formulas on the wall. Standing back and looking at the symbols, it suddenly occurred to me that in the language of mathematics, I could say something precise and meaningful about the infinite. Then something of the infinite began to wash over me. Then he says, and of course this goes on and on, but just one more sentence. Then I was floating on my back in a river of peace, under bridges of silence. It came from nowhere and flowed nowhere. Then there was no river and no I. The I had ceased to exist. Now, Arthur Koestler was not a religious person. He was an atheist when this happened to him. An atheist. In the middle of darkness. Total darkness. I want to encourage as many of you as possible to do retreat with us. To do our 7 days. You may think, oh, 7 days. How can I do 7 days? Well, you can do it. 5 days. Not 7 days. Well, you could do 2 days or 1 day, but see, it takes the mind a while to calm down. It takes the mind a while. Chatterbox Cafe has to be some calming down. It has to be the time when they quit serving food in the Chatterbox Cafe, and then people are just kind of silently looking at the paper before you have a chance to experience this. In darkness there is light. Pretty simple. Pretty simple. But we don't like it. We don't like it. We wanted some other religion. Because darkness is dark. It's disorienting. It's confusing. Talk about loneliness. Talk about longing. Why would you increase your loneliness? Why would you increase your longing by sitting facing a wall for 7 days? Are you... What was the word we used to...
You don't have to come up with anything.
Loco. Loco. Oh, what did my son used to say? Something in la cabeza. What? Something. Loco in la cabeza? The continuing with the merging of difference and oneness, I did the line, in the darkness there is light. The next line is, but don't see it as light. But don't see it as light. And unfortunately, if you look at the rest of Arthur Koestler's life and The Lotus and the Robot, it's a well-written book, but he seems to be kind of cranky. I'm kind of pissed. Now, it's been a long time since I read his stuff, so this is a faint memory. But it's like, I won't go into it. But don't see it as light. In darkness there is light, but don't see it as light. If you think, oh, I've got it, I'm enlightened. You're not. You're not. That's just end of story. End of story. You're just back in the Chatterbox Cafe, and now you've got a new TV set there. Or a new, what are we doing now? A new, Twitter account there. You've got access to tweeting. Infinite access to tweeting all everybody. But you're enlightened. So you depend on that tweeting box. See, I'm very old, so I'm trying to learn about this stuff. My son and daughter used to teach me about this stuff. Now my grandson, who's 8, is the one who's teaching me, right? Don't see it as light. You become arrogant. You become full of yourself. Or you think, geez, I want some more of that. I want more of that. 7 days, that's not long enough, Tim. Maybe I should do 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. How long did it take you, Tim? Right? The Chatterbox Cafe goes on overtime. You get extra waitresses in. Special food. right? Thinking, judging, and comparing pulls us back into the hypnotic chattering, doesn't it? Pulls us back. All we have to do is see that with a soft heart, an open heart, without putting ourselves down, because that's just another layer of chattering, isn't it? Putting yourself down. I can't do this. This sucks. You can't do it. All right, you can't do it. It sucks. All right. Just be with that. I can't do this. This sucks. Just breathe into that. Just open your heart to that. What can you really do anyway, really? What can you do? Let's face it. We can't do much of anything. Us two-leggeds. As my Lakota teacher used to say, us two-leggeds, he said, we can't do much of anything by ourselves. I don't know if the four-leggeds can or not. I'm not a four-legged. And Sekito, the author of this poem, one more line from him. So we've done the line, in darkness there is light, but don't see it as light. And then in the light there is darkness, but don't see it as darkness. In the light there is darkness, but don't see it as darkness. So when our heart is open, I sometimes use the term heart-mind. I like that. I don't know what I like. But when our heart is open, great sorrow can roll through like a wave, rolling through the sea at great depth. It can just roll on through. It can just roll on through, causing chaos and upheaval. But when the wave has passed, there's no trace. No trace at all. No trace. That's an open heart, isn't it? That's a still mind and an open heart. And that's our nature. That's our Buddha nature, we call it. Buddha is something extra. It's our nature. But we've forgotten that nature, which is why we use vacuum cleaners and romantic relationships and drugs and alcohol and all that stuff to try to deal with our pain, right? Try to deal with our pain. So after Mickey ditched me, then I went to beer. Then from beer, I won't go that way. I have my own litany, though. We all have our own litany. We all do. Even if you didn't drink or do drugs, you did something. Because life is hard. Life is hard. And then we die. It is. But, right in the middle of that, there's great stillness because we're dying with everything. And everything dies when we do. Everything gets born when we do. Everything suffers when we do. We don't think so because we cut off in the Chatterbox Cafe, but it's true. It's true. So no problem. No problem. So when I was a young man, the Japanese people who lived around me in Japantown in San Francisco, I went to a house with one of them, where one of them had a family, and they had me for dinner. And they had little children, and the little children had a big Bodhidharma doll. And some of you have heard me talk about Bodhidharma dolls before. Some of you have probably even talked about them yourselves. Bodhidharma doll. So there were a two-year-old boy in that house, and the Bodhidharma doll was about the size of the two-year-old boy. Now, raise your hands if you know who... Do I need to tell you who Bodhidharma is? Raise your hands if you know who Bodhidharma is. Oh, a lot of you don't. Okay. Well, Bodhidharma is considered the founder of Zen. And he sat in a cave doing Zen meditation for 83,000 years. You think a week is long. You think a week is long. A week is not long, you guys. If you give yourselves to it, it's not long. It's wonderful. Wonderful. Anyway, so the founder is in. I don't know if they still do this Bodhidharma doll. They had a Bodhidharma doll in the house. It was about the size of the two-year-old. And what the Bodhidharma doll is like is that it must have a lead ball. The Bodhidharma sits cross-legged. He's sitting in his cave cross-legged, right? So he's a cross-legged Bodhidharma. He's like this. And the kids knock him over, and he always comes back up. And they knock him over, and he comes back up. And they knock him one way, and he comes back up. That's resiliency. And actually, that's what I have to offer you. Resiliency. That you will become resilient through this practice. Especially if you don't think you're becoming resilient. If you think you're becoming resilient, you will not become resilient. Oh, am I more resilient than I was yesterday? I did this whole week. Tim told me to do this whole week, and I'm just mad because I'm not more resilient. That's just a chatterbox cafe. But you will become resilient. Your nature is resilience. You are resilience. That's your nature. You may be named Tim or John or Martha or Bouchot or Karen, but your nature is resilience. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. We have the capacity to develop this resilience through our meditation, by staying open as our mental and emotional tumult carouses through us. And then we just discover that stillness right here in the middle of it, right here. At any time, we may have a moment of panoramic awareness, big mind. And it may not last very long, but it's always there to tap into. It's always there to tap into. So, the basho, the banana tree, I don't know where I got this, but I read it someplace. The basho, the banana tree, the stem seems very hard, and it's hard to break through the stem. The stem has lots of layers of bark. One layer, and you get through that, and then another layer, and you get through that, and then another layer. It's like peeling an onion. In a way, Zen meditation is like that too. Oh, I got through that layer. Oh, there's another one. Four-letter word. There's another one. Another four-letter word. Three four-letter words. Another one. Another one. And when you peel the whole thing away, when you peel the whole stem away, warm water rushes up. Warm water. Of course, we're in the tropics, right? Rushes up. Gushes up. So this practice, let's see, what time is it? Okay. This practice that I'm talking about meditation is takes shraddha, or it's a Sanskrit word, and it's generally translated as faith, but I tend to prefer the word trust because you don't get to have faith in anybody who's going to help you. Your mama's not going to help you. vacuum cleaner is not going to help you. Drugs and alcohol aren't going to help you. Even your great romance isn't going to help you. So there's no God out there to have faith in. There may be a God, but not a God who's going to help, that you can depend on, who's a thing. There's no God who's a thing. Maybe this is all God. I mean, that's what Meister Eckhart said. He said to move beyond the God to the Godhead. In the Godhead, Meister Eckhart said, there's no trace of God. Oh, sounds like he's been hanging out with Sensei. Or maybe Sensei's been hanging out with him. So I prefer trust, but who cares? I prefer trust. Trust. And Buddha was asked what Shraddha meant, and he said, it's the type of trust birds have in the tree in which they build their nests. So trust in the tree. In the tree. Trust that in your body, in this fragile, painful body that you have, you can build the nest of openness and stillness, and let the Chatterbox Cafe just be there and just play itself out without doing anything at all. It's just opening your heart to it. And you know, when you open your heart to all those waitresses and all those waiters in the Chatterbox Cafe, they calm way down. They feel so appreciated. They feel that someone's paying attention to them finally. They feel like it's even better than getting the best tip. They calm way down. And the Chatterbox Cafe becomes so still. But not this phony kind of stillness where everybody has the lid on. That's not what we're talking about. This is not churchy stillness. This is vitality of water rushing out from who knows where and going who knows where. And then little rivulets forgetting. But they are all of life. And then remembering, and forgetting, and remember. And probably that's good enough length for a talk now. So let's see if there are questions or comments. Questions, comments, anybody about anything?
I will give a testimonial about...
A testimonial. Well, this is going to be a loud testimonial, then, right, Kate?
Yes, that resilience comes, it's one of those things that you just do the practice. You just do it. You don't worry about what you're going to reap from it, and then when the time comes, you find out.
Thank you. Jeffrey.
I can say something about banana trees.
Oh, boy.
Okay. I lived in Hawaii for a couple of years.
Oh.
Went over to, I guess it's the east side of Oahu, where, for some reason or another, that's where the tropical rainforest is. This is not making sense to me. Think about it. But what I want to say about banana trees is, they can be enormous. I was walking through this tropical forest, and there they are, 20 feet up in the air, 40 feet up in the air, the bunches of bananas were there.
I see. Thank you. Other folks. Yeah. Benton. Pardon?
Benton.
Yeah, I said, hi, Benton.
in the practice period, we're reading Living by Fall by Shohaku
Akamura. Uh-huh.
And right in the last page or two, he started talking about needing to have faith.
Yeah.
And he kind of lost me there because I've really had a hard time with faith myself.
Uh-huh.
Believing in something without evidence. And I believe in evidence. And I like what you're saying about calling it trust instead.
Uh-huh.
That feels a lot better.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good. I mean, that's good that word works for you. I mean, whatever words work for us, we should employ to help us help us answer this summons. The summons. We're always being summoned to return to our original stillness. We're always being summoned. We can do it in a church. We can do it by the lake. We can do it in a seven-day retreat. We're always being summoned. So whatever words help us. Yeah, so you and I, trust helps us more than faith. Yeah, Eric.
Along that note, I think that it doesn't really take faith to meditate once, but it takes a little bit of faith to decide to pursue it because you see others that seem wise or peaceful at times, and but furthermore, evidence-based people, as soon as you embark, you're gathering evidence right away. So it takes maybe curiosity.
Curiosity, all right, curiosity. That's Tony Packer. That would be her term. The Zen teacher, she considers herself an un-Zen teacher, but she's a Zen teacher. Tony Packer would say curiosity. That is, and Suzuki called that the inmost request, actually. So it's not just curiosity, it's a real deep asking, a real deep looking into. It is curiosity, but it's even deeper than that. Does that make sense, Eric? Yeah.
I don't know if there's an answer to this question. Probably not. But why are we all so lonely all the time?
Did you hear what she asked me? Why are we all so lonely all the time? it seems to be human nature. I don't know. Why are we? I mean, when I was younger, I used to think, well, if you would start kids meditating when they were little, or maybe looking at this. I used to teach meditation to kids here years ago, but the way we would, and I know they have a kids group here now that I've done a few times, but we'd go in the backyard and we'd have them look at the sky, and lie down, because they wouldn't want to sit. So when I was younger, I used to think, well, if you really integrated meditation into kids' lives, that but I don't believe that anymore. Everybody seems to have to go through this. It's part of being human and part of individuating. I mean, we have to develop separate identities. What's your name?
Deanna.
Deanna, you have to develop a Deanna identity. I have to develop a Tim identity. It's Darwinian. It's how the species survives. And as soon as I get attached to my Tim identity and you're attached to your Deanna, I begin to feel cut off from other people. I begin to feel isolated from other people. So starting meditation at an early age is good, but the problem is adolescents don't want to do meditation. So... Even, you know, I went to Bhutan, and we think, oh, well, Bhutan was, you know, very ancient Buddhist culture. They didn't have TV yet when I was there. And raise your hand if you've heard about Bhutan. More of you have heard about Bhutan, yeah. And I thought, wow, you know, that's they've cut off from Western culture for centuries, wouldn't let Westerners in, wouldn't have TV. So I went there. What did I go there? 10, 12 years ago, I thought, well, you know, I'll see what it's like, you know, when the whole culture is imbued by this meditation. Well, I went up to the Tiger's Nest, which is this monastic place. You have to climb way up high to it and meditate there, and there was the abbot and me and all these adolescent boys, shooting each other with beans and slapping each other with towels. I went to have a shower with them, and they were all slapping each other in the butt with towels. And when it was time to do chores, they were all running away and probably smoking dope. I don't know what they use for dope. So, you know, seems to be what happens. That's as close as I can get to dealing with your question.
I just
had a thought. I think your question was wonderful about loneliness, but I just think loneliness is a label that we use culturally to describe something that isn't even bad. And also, because it's got a bad rap, the label, if you look at the definition in our culture, is telling us something's wrong with us. And so I think the whole concept of labels and the way we use these words in our culture are really very lethal when it's from the Chatterbox campaign.
Very good. Did you guys hear what she said? Yeah, they heard you. Thank you. Thank you. Stacy.
Could I say similarly with seasonal affective?
Can you speak a little louder for those folks out there?
Similarly with seasonal affective disorder, and no respect to anyone that's struggling with this, but it seems like to be affected by the seasons is in order.
Yeah.
Because it's a societal problem. Saying we want it to be light all winter, we want to stay active and not sit in meditation and quiet. And not being affected by things. You're trying not to be affected.
Good point. Did you guys hear her? Thank you, Paul. Could you guys hear her?
No.
Oh, you want to say it really loud? Stand up, Stacy.
With the terminology of seasonal affectiveness disorder, we're creating these societal labels that don't mean exactly what we mean to mean. That being affected by the seasons seems to be in order. And that trying to be not affected by things is a social societal problem that we two-legged have.
So maybe seasonal affective order is good. Maybe coming to sit with, I'm here, you know, I'm really, I'm selling the, uh-oh, my teacher said, don't sell water by the river. I'm selling water by the river. Come to the 7 days of darkness. At the darkest time of year, where we can all be dark together. December 1, I think. It's usually December 1 through December 8. Buddha's Enlightenment Day is on December 8th, so that's when of course, we celebrate in the beginning. But
of course, in India, this is the lightest time of year.
Yeah. I know.
Rohatsu's Japanese.
Yeah, yeah. So, that's right. Yep. Yes.
Little bit more about the arrogance that comes when you think you're developing.
The what that comes?
The arrogance.
The arrogance that comes? Oh, well, you know, when you think, this is another thing that might be a big deal for my teacher. It should be for me too, I hope it is. When you think you've accomplished something and you rest on your laurels, those laurels are dead. Because this is entering life, and if I think I've got something tangible that makes me more of an expert in living than you, then that sense of expertise gets in the way. It mediates my relationship with you. Instead of really being there with you empathically, my expertise, my so-called enlightenment, mediates. It mediates for you, your projection. It mediates for me, my projection. Does that make sense? And of course we do mediate, but we should notice when we're mediating. We should notice it. That's the Chatterbox Cafe. We notice it. But we don't diss it. You can't burn the Chatterbox Cafe down. If you do, 30 more come up almost immediately. Yeah, one more, and then it's time's up. Oh, okay. I think Karen, we have to move on. Thank you very much. Oh, applause.